Good day, everyone. My name is Mary Texera. I am a professor emerita of sociology here at Cal State San Bernardino. Welcome to this ongoing series in which we examine race and policing. And we have a different, interesting program for you today. My colleagues will introduce our guest. But for now, I want to just welcome you. And also at the top of the hour, I would really like to acknowledge our tech support, who is Finn Lee. He's at Cal State, and also our administrative assistant person, Pamela Crossan, who is housed in the Department of History, but she's phenomenal in terms of helping us out with this series. As you can imagine, it takes a lot of folks to do something like this. So thanks to both of those folks for doing this for us. Now I'd like to turn the mic over to my colleague, Robbie Madrigal, who will introduce himself.
Thank you, Mary, and to like to add my welcome. My name is Robbie Madrigal from the Fowl Library. I'm one of the organizers of the program, and really excited about today's esteemed guest. I'll turn it over to my colleague, Jeremy Murray.
Thanks, Robbie. Jeremy Murray, I teach Chinese history here at CSUSB. And I'll turn the floor over to Amber Broaden, please.
Thank you, Jeremy. Peace and welcome, everyone. My name is Amber Broaden. I serve as an adjunct faculty in the psychology department at both CSU Dominguez Hills as well as San Bernardino, with a specialization in legal and forensic psychology. I'll pass it over to Matt.
Hello, everybody, and welcome. My name is Matt Pitino. I am an adjunct instructor of history at Crafton Hills College and a former police officer for the Rialto Police Department here in California. Before we proceed, I would like to read our land acknowledgement. We recognize that California State University San Bernardino sits on the territory and ancestral land of the San Manuel Band of Mission Indians, Yuhaviatam. We recognize that every member of the California State University San Bernardino community has benefited and continues to benefit from the use and occupation of this land since the institution's founding in 1965. Consistent with our values of community and diversity, we have a responsibility to acknowledge and make visible the university's relationship to Native peoples. By offering this land acknowledgement, we affirm Indigenous sovereignty and will work to hold the California University San Bernardino system more accountable to the needs of American Indian and Indigenous people. And now I would like to turn it over to Mike German.
Thank you, Matt. I'm Mike German. Make sure I'm not on mute. I'm a fellow with the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU Law School and a former FBI agent. And today it's my pleasure to introduce Gisela Perez Kusakawa, the first executive director of the Asian American Scholars Forum. Gisela is a civil rights leader, a policy expert, and an attorney. She previously served as the founding director and supervising attorney of the Anti-Profiling Civil Rights and National Security Program at Asian Americans Advancing Justice, AAJC, one of the largest and leading national Asian American civil rights organizations in the country. In this role, she's led their advocacy efforts on anti-profiling civil rights and national security. I got to work with Gisela as part of a project looking into a program the Justice Department had initiated called the China Initiative, which targeted Asian American scholars as suspected spies. And Gisela, I'm so happy that you're here to talk about this. When we think about racial profiling, often we don't recognize the impact that national security profiling has on at different communities in the country. So we appreciate your being here and your willingness to discuss this serious problem. So please, you have the floor, Gisela.
Well, thank you so much, Michael, and all of our moderators, and also many working behind the scenes for bringing this session together. I know it certainly takes a team. Today, as Michael mentioned, I wanted to provide a brief overview of the history of targeting of the Asian American community under the national security pretext and the current reality of increasing U.S.-China tensions that have led to the scapegoating of Asian American scholars, especially those of Chinese descent. This is a very timely conversation. We recently just passed the second year anniversary of the formal end of the China Initiative and also the day of observance to remember Japanese Americans incarcerated in our country. The misguided pouring of resources into heavily scrutinizing academics of Chinese descent today has led to a loss of talent, a diminished appeal of the United States on a global platform, and decreased diversity, participation, and leadership for Asian Americans in our country. Most recently, under the China Initiative, a DOJ program allegedly aimed at combating espionage, there has been measurable impact. A survey conducted by ASF scientists published under the Proceedings of the National Academy of Science between December 2021 and March 2022 of over 1,300 faculty members nationwide showed an overwhelming majority of the survey respondents, 89%, would like to contribute to U.S. leadership in science and technology, but 72% feel unsafe, and 42% are fearful of conducting research in the United States. Further, around 61% of the survey respondents feel pressure to leave the United States, especially our next generation of junior faculty and federal grant awardees. Moreover, nearly half of the respondents, 45%, intend to avoid federal grant applications, especially engineering and computing science faculty and senior faculty, due to fear. Unfortunately, this cyclical targeting is not new. Asian Americans have been a long part of the history in our country, and yet for as long as Asian Americans have been in the United States, generations and generations have been perceived and continue to be perceived as perpetual foreigners. In 1882, for example, after the completion of the Transcontinental Railroad in 1869 and an economic depression, the Chinese Exclusion Act was introduced in Congress to exclude Chinese laborers. In court, the government's determination was the presence of foreigners of a different race in this country who will not assimilate with us is dangerous to its peace and security. The consequences of being perceived as perpetually foreign and unjustly as the representative of a foreign government and or entity has proven time and time again to be used as a rationale for acts of injustice against Asian Americans. Last year, I attended the 40th anniversary of the Coram Nobis cases that overturned the convictions of Gordon Hirabayashi, Minoru Yasui, and Fred T. Korematsu, civil rights icons who went to the courts and challenged the injustices that thousands of Japanese Americans and immigrants face in what is one of the darkest stains in our country. These cases shed critical light to the history of the United States scapegoating Asian Americans and immigrant communities as the threat in the name of national security, and helps us understand how this cycle continues to this day. Decades after the Supreme Court had upheld Fred Korematsu's conviction, a federal court vacated his conviction, warning that the Korematsu case stands as a constant caution that in times of war or declared military necessity, our institutions must be vigilant in protecting constitutional guarantees. The court instructed that national security must not be used to protect government actions from close scrutiny and accountability. The Japanese American incarceration cases have profound connections with the treatment of many communities of color in the past and today who continue to be targets of government surveillance, prosecution, and violence. It is critical for us to remember that when Japanese Americans were incarcerated, that rationale, the ability of average people to be able to speak up, was something that was very challenging and very difficult. And it's a lesson for us to learn to this day. Over 120,000 Japanese Americans were rounded up, and this included not only adults, but also children and US citizens. And this scapegoating applies not only during times of war, but also times of competition and tensions between the United States and an Asian country. A notable case that many within the Asian American civil rights community know of is that of Vincent Chin, a Chinese American who was murdered in 1982 by two white men who mistook him as Japanese at a time when US-Japan tensions were high due to economic competition. The two men walked away with just a $3,000 fine. Qin Yi, president then of the Detroit Chinese Welfare Council, claimed that the light sentence essentially gave them a license to kill. In the modern age, Asian Americans still make for convenient scapegoats. Alarmingly, 1 in 5 Americans believe that Asian Americans are partly responsible for COVID-19. And 1 in 3 Americans believe Asian Americans are more loyal to countries other than the US. The perception of Asian Americans as perpetual foreigners and potential threats to national security persists even decades after the incarceration of Japanese Americans during World War II. And it's critical for us to consider this, especially at the height of tensions between the United States and a foreign Asian country, including in this current day and age with that of China. I remember the quote of Fred T. Korematsu that I often think of, where he warned that no one should ever be locked away simply because they share the same race, ethnicity, or religion as a spy or terrorist. If that principle was not learned from the internment of Japanese Americans, then these are very dangerous times for our democracy. But despite this warning, we continue to see today questions of Asian Americans of their loyalty and years of families being harmed because they've been subjected to unjust scrutiny. Now, this current modern targeting of Asian American scholars, as I mentioned, intensified under the Department of Justice's now defunct China initiative. This wreaked havoc on the lives of many Asian American scholars that ASF works with, including Professor Anming Hu and Professor Gong Chen, who is now on our leadership. As I mentioned, this initiative was allegedly focused on combating espionage, and yet many of the allegations had nothing related to it. Perhaps the most notable case under the China initiative is that of Dr. Gong Chen, a widely respected Chinese American mechanical engineering professor and nanotechnologist at MIT. In 2001, he had joined MIT, and where he has made major academic contributions in the field of thermal engineering. But then in 2021, after years of service and dedication, FBI agents had raided Dr. Chen's home, arrested him, and accused him of federal grant fraud. The government alleged that Dr. Chen failed to disclose connections with Chinese research institutions in federal grant applications and failed to report a bank account in China in his 2018 tax returns. He was subject of a long investigation under this initiative. Like many other Asian American scientists and researchers, Dr. Chen had his loyalty questioned during a press conference and was scapegoated as a national security threat. Just a few hours after his arrest, U.S. Attorney Andrew Lehling spoke on television stating that the allegations in the complaint implied that this was not just about greed, but about loyalty to China. And in a press release, he alleged that Dr. Chen was engaged in efforts to promote China's scientific and economic development. However, the actual charges brought against Dr. Chen were not espionage or disloyalty claims. Instead, he was charged with wire fraud, failure to file a report of a foreign bank account, and making a false statement. It was clear that there was a strong narrative that was hovering over Dr. Chen and many scientists that they are simply not loyal to the United States. While Dr. Chen's arrest, unlike many of those before him, had triggered something within the Asian American scholar community, a community that is not known for necessarily speaking out loud and making a ruckus, his arrest galvanized many scholars across the country under the mantra of "We are all Gong Chen." Earlier in the year, the Department of Justice had dropped all charges against Dr. Chen, but Dr. Chen and many of the people in the community were forever changed. According to Dr. Chen, he had been living through a living hell, and many of his colleagues and peers were very scared that if Dr. Chen could be harmed and targeted and questioned for his loyalty, then what does that mean for the regular Asian American scholars across the country? And so the We Are All Gung Chen continued to resonate, and this is part of the reason that AASF became an organization. Unlike many nonprofits, our organization really started from the ground up as a grassroots movement of Asian American scholars deciding that it was critical that they also have a voice in this country, that they have a seat at the table, and that they have the ability to fight for their rights. Now, one of the biggest challenges, of course, is even though the prosecution was dropped, Dr. Chen and many others like him continue to face trauma and questions of accountability. A quote that I want to share from Dr. Chen that was something that was very painful to hear was when he mentioned, "You work hard, you have good input, you build a reputation, but in the end, you're treated like a spy. That just breaks your heart. It breaks your confidence." Many of the Asian American scholars that we work with are people that came to the United States with dreams of being able to essentially fulfill the American dream, reach freedom, equality, happiness. And to find, especially at this age, many of them grandparents, that their loyalty would be questioned and that they would be living under this type of environment is something that's very difficult for many of them to experience. His story is reflective of many fears in the community and how the targeting of the Asian American community is something that is not yet over and is something we have to be not only vigilant for, but as a community, make sure that we self-organize and create the foundation so that next generations would have more resources and are not going through this alone. But this is not only a humanitarian and civil rights issue. Unfortunately, we're also shooting ourselves in the foot and failing to attract and retain some of the best and brightest talents in the world to the United States. And so we really hope that many of the Asian American scholars can be recognized for their contributions, but also treated as humans and people that really came to the United States to build a family, follow their dream, pursue their research. I've talked to scientists who still continue to do their research and make lesson plans, even when they're under scrutiny, because they're doing what they love to do. AASF is here to provide them with support, but also make sure that we bridge many of these scholars with legal professionals who could really make sure that we provide them with the protections and ability to navigate very complicated environments in today's current environment. So I'm just very excited for today's dialogue, to speak with many of you all today and really hear back from the students.
Thank you so much, Gisela. The only thing I'll disagree with is I have found in my advocacy career that the Asian American groups are often the most active and earliest to the fight, regardless of who's being targeted, because of that history that you mentioned. And particularly the way that the scholars, and I think it's hard to overstate the level of fear when your community is targeted as a threat to the nation's security. And the way that the scholars have united in solidarity to make sure that the government is held to account, because one of the things that alarmed me about the China initiative and the cases leading up to the China initiative was how many resulted in charges being dismissed and cases being lost at trial, which is unusual. In the federal system, when the FBI charges a case and the US Attorney's Office prosecutes, they have a very high conviction rate. So it jumped out to me, and I was fortunate enough to engage with you and many of the other Asian American groups that were working on this. And I'll put a link in to the webinar that you helped produce for APA Justice. But nobody would doubt that there is a legitimate concern about economic espionage, government agents from other countries trying to steal technology and intellectual property developed here in the United States. But what was unique about the China initiative was how quickly it moved away from, even though economic espionage is what justified it, it moved very quickly to charging very different kind of cases and looking instead at what they called academic integrity. And can you explain that transition and what they actually ended up looking at in some of these big cases, like you mentioned with Gang Chen and Anming Hu?
No, absolutely. And I think, Michael, that was where we were really shooting ourselves in the foot. It was starting to really confuse academic integrity cases where perhaps professors made a mistake on the disclosure form, or there perhaps are miscommunications between a faculty member and their university and with the federal agency, between actual cases of economic espionage that pose national security threats. And this is something that we're still continuing to tackle. What we had found, especially when you think about these academic integrity cases, that many professors were getting in trouble for allegations that were fundamentally rooted in their failure to disclose activities that were not illegal themselves. So these activities could be that I went to a conference in China. It could be that I had worked with this Chinese international student. And so it became a very difficult environment where it felt more like a gotcha opportunity and targeting of many of these professors. When you think about the record of how long the research history is for these professors, they have decades and decades of research work. So many students that are going through their classrooms. Imagine you as a professor having to be liable for all of the students that go through your course or students that you're working with research assignments on, not only on their past conduct, but also potentially on their future conduct as well. This was the environment and continues to be the environment of fear that many scholars are facing right now. So when we commend the end of the formal end of the China initiative, we are commending a de-escalation and a recognition that many of these normal academic routine activities were being criminalized. But it still led to this question of, well, how do we handle these academic integrity cases in the future? How do we harmonize many of these requirements for disclosure that is frankly very difficult, not only for the faculty members, but for the universities to really understand? One thing that many of the professors mentioned is that it was only a couple of years ago when collaborations, when more openness was something that we had celebrated. And in fact, if you were a professor that could connect your university with another university abroad, you added additional value to that university. Now, you can't change your past history anymore just because suddenly this is something that is not looked well upon anymore because of US-China tensions. This doesn't mean that you can change what you've done in the past. What are you supposed to disclose now? This is still something that is very challenging for the professors to navigate, and certainly even more challenging in understanding what could actually take that leap from an academic integrity case towards something that could lead to criminal prosecution.
And one of the issues that I want to make clear for the audience is that, you know, there are certainly scientists and technologists who are working on national security projects. But what we're talking about with the China initiative is mostly targeting people who are working in fundamental research that has nothing to do with national security and is, in fact, research that they're publishing. So there are no secrets involved in it. And the chilling effect of these kinds of investigations, because it's not just the people who are charged, right? For every high profile scientist or researcher or professor who's charged, there are dozens of others who just get a knock on their door or have their university visited by an FBI agent. Can you talk about how that is harming our scientific achievement by creating this chilling effect?
No, absolutely. And I like that you raised, Michael, the fundamental research component, because I think this is where a lot of the chilling effect comes from. The professors understand the difference between classified and non-classified information, but the rules are changing for how we're going to treat non-classified research, how we're going to treat fundamental research. When you think about fundamental research, these are all something that is published. You can find it yourself. You can Google much of what the professors are researching. Their invention is out there. And it's really because of a mentality that this is for the greater good of mankind, right? These are professors who are following their dreams. They're pursuing cancer research. They're trying to discover the cure for so many illnesses. And even Professor Gong Chen, recently he had him and his team had found a new material that enhances our ability to essentially for CHIPS technology, which is precisely what the United States wants. And yet we are pushing many of these talents away by making them fearful of the research that they're doing that's largely public. This is more of a debate on the future of how the United States is going to handle open science, how they're going to handle fundamental research. But what we see time and time again, especially in our country, is that when we make these changes, we often have communities of color face the initial brunt. It is going to be Asian American scholars as we transition who are going to face heightened scrutiny. They're going to be the test subjects. And unfortunately, it's going to mean that they're going to go through so many prosecutions, investigations, not just during the China Initiative, but currently to this day. We've heard of so many stories of international students being stopped at the border, not being able to return to their classes, stories of professors who are questioned about the students that they're working with. And this really disincentivizes people from not only working with international students, but working with anyone that's perceived to be of Chinese descent. This impacts white American faculty members from wanting to work with their Asian American colleagues. This also disincentivizes Asian American faculty from being the lead in their research group. Perhaps they will let one of their other colleagues who's not of Asian descent take the lead because that way you get less scrutiny. And for many of these professors, they care more about the research than being the head of a group. But it's really important when we think in our country, why must they hide? Why must many of them not participate in leadership positions, not apply for certain federal grants, when so much of this research is something that's just out there for the public? This is not private information.
Thank you. Mary, I saw you had your hands up, but I didn't.
I did. Thank you. Thank you, Michael. And thank you, Gisela, for that wonderful introduction to this really important topic. I don't know a lot about international espionage or what's happening with scholars, but I have taught media and Asian American images in my classes in the past. And I remember one picture that was the official picture. You've probably seen this, the official picture of the Transcontinental Railroad when it was done. And they had all of these, the people who worked on the railroad, including Chinese Americans. The real picture versus the official picture that was published, and they just erased all of the Chinese workers on that railroad. So a few years later, the Chinese Exclusion Act came along, but they were excluded even before that, you know, because of. But when you think about all of the negative images, this only makes sense. You know, I mean, I don't agree with it, but it only makes sense. So thank you for that. The other thing I wanted to ask you about, even though he was technically not a scholar or not a, a professor, Wen Ho Lee, the case of Wen Ho Lee, which I think was especially egregious in terms of how this poor man was treated. Would you care to talk about him for just a little bit?
No, absolutely. And Wen Houli was actually a Taiwanese-American scientist. So right. In 1999, he'd worked on the development of nuclear weapons and was charged with espionage amid reports that China was acquiring nuclear secrets. He had been surveilled for about 3 years, but they failed to find any direct evidence of espionage. The government, despite this, had accused him still of assembling classified information and transferring those to a different computer. He was arrested. He was in solitary confinement for 278 days. But the court later dismissed the case. And what you will actually find is that the judge in that case had a very long apology for Dr. Wen Houli. And his case is actually part of the reason that Asian American Scholar Forum exists to this day, because at the time that Wen Houli was accused, there wasn't this community support system for Asian American scientists and researchers. And we wanted to make sure that they had the support, because part of the consequence of these investigations, these allegations, even if you found yourself, if you were able to prove your innocence, many of them suffer backlash within their community by their peers. Their reputation is impacted. They find it extremely difficult to continue to work at their universities. And many after Dr. Wen Houli faced this as well. I've talked to scientists where they become isolated from their community. Friends don't want to speak with them because they're scared that any association could potentially lead to them also being targeted and investigated. And so this environment of fear is something that we are essentially trying to change. It's over two decades since Dr. Wen Houli's case, and yet we're finding this similar treatment of Chinese American scientists and scholars to this day. And I think the key thing is really, and I love how you talked about the media, Mary, because initially, and I know Mike saw this, we saw the media was handling this narrative very differently. They would sometimes just pull from the DOJ website, and it was quite irresponsible, just put out those headlines on a newspaper. And what would happen is average people without a legal background or experience with police investigations will just assume that this means you're guilty. They had so much trust in the government that they felt, well, if the government's investigating you, something must be wrong with you. You must have done something. And so it took a long time to get the media to change how they were covering this story. And also a long time even for the national security experts to understand that no matter how many times you recommend and say, don't assume that Chinese Americans and are representative of China's government, these biases exist. People will have natural reactions when they see these headlines, when they see these allegations. And so we have to also think of those impacts. And that's why it's so important that we understand the responsibility we have in our country to make sure that these narratives don't stay, that this perception that Asian Americans, that Chinese Americans are not loyal, that they could be suspected right away, could just take one accusation and their reputation and their lives could just fall down like a house of cards. That's not going to be a welcoming environment for this community. And so I think it is something that unfortunately takes many decades, but also my perspective, a permanent nonprofit to represent a community, to be able to win some of these lasting changes in the narrative.
Thank you. Matt, you have a question?
I do. Hi, Gazella. You've touched on a couple of the things that I was interested in, primarily when it comes to racial or ethnic biases. So I guess my question here, and you touched a little bit also on perceived ideology, which tended to drive, I guess, some of the after effects of the initiative, and probably some of the actions or overreach that the FBI took and DOJ took. I am curious, though, if you happen to know how many of those indictments actually succeeded in uncovering espionage rather than some more benign charge.
I don't have the exact number, but I, Mike may be more aware of this, but it has been difficult for us to get evidence from the government on how widespread exactly the problem that they're presenting is. And instead, it has been placed more of a burden on the community to find evidence of how this is directly impacting US leadership and science and technology. But it's largely a few bad actors. But then just because of that, it has led to this accusation that somehow this sense of scrutiny is something that should be put among all scientists of Chinese descent in the United States.
And Matt, I just put an article that Massachusetts Institute of Technology, Technology Review, MIT Technology Review, did the most extensive study of the China Initiative cases. And basically they went to the Justice Department website where they announced, where they identified specific cases as China Initiative cases. And you know, I think any of the advocacy groups that Giselle and I worked with would acknowledge there are Chinese spies. You know, the Chinese government does engage in myriad kinds of bad conduct, and it's very important for the government and for the FBI to focus on those. But these cases did not catch many spies. A very small minority of those cases were actually involving not just espionage of national security secrets, but economic espionage as well. Most of them were in this academic integrity. Somebody didn't fill out a form correctly, or you know, didn't indicate that they had a summer job somewhere. You know, that was part of their history as an academic. And in my mind, and again, what jumped out to me was how many were failed prosecutions, you know, even though they weren't looking for it. And Giselle, maybe this will be a good way to talk about it. It's the case against Professor Anming Hu in Tennessee, which kind of in many ways encompassed all the things I saw wrong with the China Initiative. That, you know, once you take a law enforcement agency and you don't have, you know, usually they're looking for a specific violation. You're charged with investigating economic espionage. So you would go out and you try to find people who are stealing trade secrets and intellectual property. Where once the Trump administration in 2018 identified it as the China Initiative, you're no longer looking for economic espionage first. First, you're looking for some link to China, and Chinese ancestry became an easy shortcut. And you know, that's really the definition of racial profiling that we see, right? That you start with a suspect community. The FBI agent in that case testified that he just Googled, you know, he was assigned to the China Initiative, so he just Googled Chinese scholars and found Anming Hu. And Giselle, if you can talk about that case a little bit.
No, I'm happy to, Michael. And I think it just goes to show you, Matt, how difficult it has been for us to find measures from the federal government and enforcement and understanding what exactly are they looking for? And what is the standard in which they are starting these investigations? So the part of the reason that the case that Mike brought up has been so important because Dr. Anming Hu was actually the first Asian American scholar to go through trial under the China Initiative. He didn't expect to be. He is this professor in University of Texas, Knoxville, never thought that he would become the center of this national debate on the China Initiative. And he actually immigrated from Canada And so, you know, his case was something that no one would have expected would really be at the forefront. And at times his wife had requested, just come back to Canada. It's clear that you're not welcome in the United States. But, you know, Professor Aming, who loves his university, and the reason we continue to experience this sort of a better climate in many ways is because he didn't give up on his case. So the allegation specifically with Dr. Aming Hu was really centered around a summer job advising research students at the Beijing University, which was his alma mater. So it was alleged that he had failed on some sort of disclosure. Now, mind you, none of this is considered illegal activity in any way. And actually, what was eventually found by the results of this case was that Dr. Aming Hu was actually a very transparent professor, to the point that he, one of the things his attorney mentioned is he actually grabbed his letter, went directly to his university and said, is this okay? Is everything okay? He had disclosed everything, and yet there was still all this narrative around his case. And part of that was you had these FBI agents that had gone to the university, conducted this presentation for University of Knoxville staff. And that was a very intimidating experience for many of them. So it wasn't until the facts of the case started uncovering that not only the jury themselves, but people at Dr. Aming Hu's university started realizing that there was no real grounds for the level of attention and scrutiny that Professor Aming Hu was facing. And there were real repercussions for this for him. He was incarcerated through home detention. He was under house arrest for 18 months. He had no job, no income. And it was a very depressing experience for him. But he continued to do what he loved, which was his research. And he continued to profess his innocence, arguing that he was not intentionally defrauding NASA or anyone, that the form itself didn't actually ask or inquire about any of these types of disclosures. And so what you're finding is that it is being criminalized how these disclosure forms are being used, when it's something that really should be handled within the university itself or in the fixing of how these forms are going to be, right? Now NASA knows perhaps if that information is so important to them, they should update their forms to clarify what information they're actually seeking from the professors. And yet this, rather than going through that process where you're continuing to update these disclosure forms, letting the professors know, you're going through a very difficult process where you have criminalized making any mistakes. And in this case, Dr. Aming Hu didn't even make a mistake because it wasn't required in disclosure form. But you've criminalized it, and you have resulted in going through the very difficult process of putting all these individuals through years of trial, through years of potential harm and impact. You know, Dr. Aming Hu is a green card holder. This has potential ramifications to his pathway for citizenship. And it is very challenging. But what was very great to see about Dr. Aming Hu's case is how this, you know, and you'll see him if you ever hear Dr. Aming Hu talk. He is as innocent and frank as it comes as a person, that in many ways, that innocence about him just it showed how unfair and unjust this scrutiny was for Dr. Hu. He is someone that doesn't consider himself to be the top Asian American scientist in the country. The idea that he would receive this much attention was something that was, you know, very new for him. And the jury could see that this was a very honest scholar. But the idea is, Do you have to be perfect the way that Dr. Aming Hu was, the way that Dr. Gung Chen was, or should we handle these systemic issues that is happening when we criminalize these activities?
It just struck me. It almost seems as though the initiative, however, its intention, whatever good intention was there, this almost sounds like, if your initial investigation is going to be as rigorous as opening a Google search and, oh, there's a name, I think I'll focus there. This almost seems like this was a crime in search of a suspect rather than actually digging anything out. Or am I misreading it?
You bring up a good point, Matt, because something that Dr. Aming Hu has always found frustrating is that his resume is out there publicly. And you can see in his public resume that he mentioned exactly what they told him he failed to disclose. So he's not seeking to hide anything. All of this information is out there. The resumes of these professors are not typical resumes. They're in scientific research, and so they're tremendously long. It is very difficult to complete these disclosure forms for them in understanding what has to be included, what doesn't. If this is really something that is so challenging, give them the opportunity to submit everything. But those forms don't allow that, right? And so it does put the burden on many of these scholars themselves.
And I think you're correct, Matt, that interesting in the way that some of the prosecutors and FBI officials have talked about it, that creating that level of fear was part of what they saw was success. Was that, spies will be afraid to come here because we're being so aggressive at people who aren't spies, which it is confounding logic. But I think is the way all racial profiling by law enforcement works in some context, right? We're trying to suppress an entire community. So if the community is in fear of, unreasonable police interference with their daily lives, they may act differently. And that's really a big part of the problem. Go ahead, Mary.
Well, I was just going to piggyback on what Matt was saying. We grow up with these spy stories. James Bond was like my first spy, and he could solve everything. There was even spy kids. And, we have to have dozens and dozens of spy agencies throughout the United States and throughout the world. And you would think, first of all, that they could come up with 26 people who wanted to fly a plane but didn't want to learn how to land it. Thus, we have 9/11. You wonder how it's almost like a house of cards that, you don't expect a spy to Google anything. Mm. And it's really, really baffling. But my question was, and forgive me if I missed it, but your organization, you're almost like a clearinghouse, or you present papers, right? Or you put together papers on these scholars who are accused. But if I am a scholar, if I am a Chinese or an Asian scholar who has been, or who feels like something may be happening, I don't like the way the wind is blowing. Can I contact your agency, and is that the protocol, or how does it work?
Yeah, and Mary, I think it's really sort of a kind of a teamwork. So Asian American Scholar Forum is here as a community organization that's meant to provide Asian American scholars with a platform. So that includes using one, their tremendous research talents and be able to bring up the survey and reports that I mentioned earlier on to show sort of the impact directly on the community, but also a platform in Congress, the White House, and with many of these federal agencies, because they are a unique community in that not only are they directly impacted, but they have the expertise that our country needs the most. They are both scientists, researchers, and professors, but they have the lived experience as Asian Americans. So they can handle this intersection of discrimination, and what are the actual policies that could help the United States maintain leadership in science and technology. So I consider, you know, many of them don't like to see themselves as victims. They see themselves as potential thought partners and leaders in making sure that the United States is not making a bad decision, not only on the civil rights front, but also in for our American interest in trying to win global competition, right? For those who are impacted, individual scholars on the ground, they can reach out to ASF for that community of support, the resources, and also feel empowered that they could also be a part of the solution and shaping of our country and have that seat at the table with us. And then work with, you know, many of my partnering organizations like Advancing Justice AJC that has a legal referral program. You know, Mike, where we prefer to work directly with Michael for a lot of the FBI engagement. So I think it really does take a, you know, community, and long-term ASF does plan to set up a legal defense and education fund to help financially with a lot of these cases, because they do drag on. And unfortunately, many of these individual scientists, they, you know, it's a bit of a loophole. They're not in enough need to get pro bono support from Asian American scholars. But by the end of their case, folks will have lost their homes, their jobs, and will not be able to afford legal counsel to finish their cases and prove their innocence. And that's why you'll see, that's part of the reason you'll kind of hear the reports of people leaving the country, right? Because the sheer amount of financial and personal costs to be able to continue to fight for their innocence is very challenging for many of them. So I certainly recommend folks to reach out to ASF directly, and we are happy to be a platform to connect them to all of these different organizations that could provide them with support. And hopefully in the future, we'll be able to provide financial support as well. There's so many conflicts in the legal space. You can't provide financial support and provide legal referrals at the same time. So we all have our own niches of ways that we can support individuals.
Which is why it's so important that we all work together, and you know, Asian American Scholars Forum has been an excellent addition to the groups of Asian American civil rights groups that are out there. But it's very important, thank you, Mary, for raising that question, that people know their rights, because especially when you have a community that's a predominantly immigrant community or first generation or second generation Americans, often they don't know that when an FBI agent knocks on your door, that you have the right to say, no, thank you, I'd like to speak to an attorney. I'll take your card and my attorney will get back to you. But that's very important. And it's also important for scholars to understand that their university counsel is not necessarily their counsel. In other words, they represent the university and the university's interests, which may diverge from the scholar's personal interest. So it's really important to reach out to get competent legal advice from somebody like the American Civil Liberties Union or Asian Americans Advancing Justice or many of the other groups that do those kinds of Know Your Rights programs. And I know, Gisela, that you were very involved in those at AAJC.
And Mike brings up a good point that, you know, when you think about these scholars, they were not aware of their legal rights. And the culture within the scholar community, especially when it comes to research in the scientific space, is that more information, more knowledge leads to the truth. And so many of them will say everything that they could to these FBI agents, not understanding that, you know, they could be put in a very difficult situation as a result. And to your point, Matt, perhaps it made them an ideal target in many ways, that you have this trusting community that wants to just provide you with as much information as possible. All their disclosures are available online. And so it's very clear for you to see, well, they forgot something in this disclosure form because I just Google search and they didn't include this one time 12 years ago when they did this research with this one scientist. So we've got them on something.
Jeremy.
Just a quick comment. Thank you so much, Gisela, for your work and for this organization. And I hope, and Mike's excellent advice there, that's so important for people to hear. I just wanted to have a quick comment because some of the things that you were saying reminded me of this chilling effect, but also another metaphor sort of muddying the waters for what Mike notes as real issues that may become a problem. That is, with this sort of scattershot approach to it by people who aren't terribly well informed to come after people based on family history. It reminded me a little bit of the importance of an idea that's really come under fire, especially on the right, but increasingly from the center, and that is the DEI initiatives, diversity, equity, inclusion. For a number of reasons, those ideas are coming under fire, again, not just from the right, but also from people in the center, because the sort of drumbeat from the right of this sort of opposition to these ideas is so strident and so consistent and so sort of disciplined in its messaging. But I think that the work you're doing is a really substantial counter to that kind of unthinking opposition to this, and the very sophisticated often thinking that goes into the kind of work that is diversity, equity, inclusion, which is sometimes seen as sort of a handout or some kind of generosity. When in fact, and I think this reminds me a little bit of the film Oppenheimer, which wasn't a terrific film, I thought, but it sort of soft-pedaled a lot of really important issues. But it did have a throwaway line with the general who said in the later portion of the film, I wouldn't have hired any of these guys. He said, they asked him bluntly, they said, would you have hired Oppenheimer? He said, no, I wouldn't have hired him based on his sort of leftist affiliations. And then he said, like, as they're kind of pushing him out the room, he said, well, I wouldn't have hired any of these guys. And so because of that sort of ideological taint, let alone a sort of racist approach to this, the best scientists in the room are not going to be in the room. And that's the work of what is today called diversity, equity, and inclusion, also human resources, also addressing issues of racism, sexism, homophobia in the workplace. So if we take this same sort of opposition to DEI work, that we see today from the right, and again, increasingly from the center, and apply it to this moment, this historical moment, that the Oppenheimer, the Manhattan Project doesn't get done. It doesn't get across the finish line because of this sort of unthinking opposition to the urgent work of counter-racism and counter-sexism and countering homophobia in the workplace. And I just wanna really thank you for that. And it's so practical and it's so obvious. That this work needs to energetically continue for really the health of our intellectual discourse, but actually for our national security, amazingly, that's such an urgent project. I just want to thank you for that.
No, absolutely, Jeremy, and I think you bring it up on this much higher level discussion because I think Oppenheimer is a perfect example. Many of the Asian American scholars were telling me they wished that Madame Wu was represented because she was a key part of the Manhattan Project, a female Asian American a scientist. And I think that one of our goals here at ASF is to not have the Asian American scientists and scholar community respond to the targeting and scrutiny by taking a step back. Instead, we want them to be at the forefront. You know, I've talked to some universities and I've told them, you know, you shouldn't be surprised that some of your top Asian American scientists are the ones that are going to be under scrutiny or under investigation. And so there is the fear in the community that your excellence, the work that you've put in, could actually make you stand out and become more of a target. And what we're working on is to not have people be scared to be standing or taking a picture with an Asian American scholar. We don't want them scared to be working with a Chinese American professor, with a student. We want them to really feel pride in the work they've done. And we're actually going to be recently joined the task force that's working on the feasibility of the first National Asian Pacific American Museum in the country. And part of our goal is to lift up these contributions, right? Because how many people know that it was an Asian American behind our ability to save a video game or to have these video calls? Instead, the perspective is that Asian Americans are scientists are potential national security threats because of the information or research that they're doing. We don't remember them for how they've helped us in our daily lives or really been critical in the fundamentals of American society and our, how we use our technology. And so once that narrative shift is happening, once people actually know that Asian American history that's been so invisible, we won't have this lasting perception that connects them only to the feelings of foreignness. And I think that's what's really, you know, critical. We have this long history of Asian Americans in our country, but we actually don't know really much about how much they've shaped the country. And so that's what makes this series so important, because we could lend some visibility to what's happening right now. And hopefully, like you mentioned, Jeremy, with a lot of the DEI work, that we actually change our educational system so the next generation of federal agency employees, agents, attorneys, don't have these perceived biases. And also that peers don't take advantage of this environment and use it against many of their colleagues. We want to kind of align in our values of inclusion.
I think you're muted, Mike.
Sorry, I wanted to give everybody else a chance if you had a question, Amber or Robbie.
Or just... Well, I just wanted to mention, thank you so much, Gisella, for that wonderful presentation. You mentioned Vincent Chin and the incidents of anti-Asian hate that surged during the pandemic. And I just wanted to mention that didn't happen in a vacuum. It's part of a long genealogy of anti-Asian violence that goes back to the 19th century. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I think what's so interesting about it, Robbie, is I had a professor once mention that he had gotten yelled at on the street for being Asian, and then was also simultaneously worried about how he was filling out his disclosure forms. And so these scholars are facing it on two fronts. You know, anti-Asian hate that you're seeing, especially for the elderly within our community, and then this specific targeting of scholars. And I think one of the things I did want to add that's, I think, very unique to the Asian American professor community is many of them have actually experienced discrimination and scrutiny in China. They come from families of professors and intellectuals, and that's part of the reason that many of them came to the United States, because they wanted to escape that targeting. And mind you, they still very much believe in working with the system here in the United States, because they see a lot of hope that when you actually do self-organize here, things can happen. And so, you know, I think that history, the vacuum is really critical, and understand that it's not happening in a vacuum is really critical, but also understanding the immigrant experiences that these professors have and where they're coming from, where they fled an authoritarian regime, and they're looking for that freedom here in the United States. And many of us, Mike and others in the room, are working to make sure that that freedom and that American dream will actually become a reality for them.
Beautiful. Well said.
Yeah. I really wanted to piggyback off of everyone here, especially Robbie. This conversation really opened my eyes. There was a lot of crossover that I can understand seeing within the African-American community, right? But I think that the way that you've broken down this critical concern was just really eye-opening for me, analyzing the collateral damage of trauma or cross-generational effects of trauma. You know, I think that that's something that I try to uplift within my classes, right? Really bringing to the forefront how this is not just a newer issue, right? But the conversation is changing, the work is advancing. So I just really wanted to say thank you so much for opening our eyes today.
Thank you, Amber. And in many ways, the Asian American scholar community's experience of civil rights was shaped by a lot of the advocacy that the Black American community has done. For example, for many of them, questioning the government is something that is so unnatural. But they saw, you know, how Black Americans fought against profiling when it comes to policing. And there was this phrase that happened early on where it was Chinese while researching. I think, Mike, you may have seen that. And you could tell that realization largely came from the Black American civil rights work to make Americans aware of profiling generally. And I think that's what has made it easier for us to even start the conversation on racial profiling within the sort of intelligence space, because I think that is a very complicated area to touch on. And without the foundation of racial profiling in regular domestic policing work, it'd be really challenging to even tackle it when you're talking about, you know, these types of cases where there's also an international component. Another thing that I did want to add that I think is particularly challenging for Asian Americans is we are a predominantly immigrant population. I immigrated here. And so when you think about how this could impact our pipeline for new Americans, this type of scrutiny is something that changes the very demographic of Asian Americans and their ability to remain an influential community here in the United States. And so that is also something that, you know, we continue to think about, especially as there are scholars that started out their career here in the United States as international students and went on to become professors and have families and children here. How is this going to impact us many years down the line when we start to see that our universities are just having less Asian Americans?
And it's important to recognize that more than a third, I believe, of Nobel laureates, US Nobel laureates, are immigrants. So great value. So Gisela, thank you so much for your work and for being here with us today. And Jeremy, I don't know if you have remarks to close us out with.
I can. I'm happy to do it. But it's really an honor to have you here, Gisela. Thank you, Mike, for putting the event together. Robbie, Matt, Amber, and Mary. And of course, as always, Thinley, who keeps us on point with technical matters, and Pamela Crossan with administrative matters. Thank you so much, Gisela. I hope you'll join us again and keep us apprised of these issues.
Thank you.
Thank you all so much.
That's wonderful. Thanks.
Thank you.